Bob Lesniewski, welcome to Power and Witness.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, we had you on Life on the Rock, and just want to get sort of a little backstory about your own journey. Maybe let's go pre-Denver. Say, you were raised in a Catholic home, and
yeah, I was raised in, I guess a pretty Catholic home. My parents were both, really involved in our parish and that kind of thing. When I was kind of finishing high school, my parents split up, and that was kind of a train wreck because it was, they were both very churchy people, and so that was kind of a big blow for me and my siblings.
But you were out of high school, or you were?
I was finishing high school, so it was kind of that summer going into college. But it had been kind of imploding for a few years, and there was a lot of mess without getting into all of it that came along with that. And I think just at that point it was, I felt very broken, discouraged. For me, I instead of turning to God, I kind of turned to girls to fill that hole. And it just, I wouldn't say I lived a life of debauchery or anything like that, but I definitely, was looking to have my heart satisfied, elsewhere from God. But I had gone on a retreat when I was, junior high or something. And that was when I decided I want to follow God. But, it was really convenient in high school to, popularity or other things kind of seemed more attractive to not be following God very closely. But in the end, that the event of my family kind of imploding there, it actually did eventually, I think, push me into the arms of God. God used it, which he does all the time, right? Is he used something ugly for something beautiful? And it definitely was. I ended up going to Franciscan University of Steubenville. Wasn't sure about it, but I went there. My mom wanted me to check it out, and it was there that I realized, I needed to kind of really fully give my heart, as broken as it was at the time, to God. And it was there that I kind of felt like I heard this call in my life to do ministry to young people.
And what did you study?
I went into studying theater, and then I ended up changing to theology and catechetics. Mm. So that's where I met my wife there. But really felt like God kind of satisfied some of my desires, for different things that I thought was cool, and things that interest me through theology and catechetics. I love working with young people. It's all I've ever done now. But that was kind of, I feel like, the beginning of that call.
Yeah. And were you in the class with Stefanik and Jason?
Yes. Yes. Jason, I was in Jason Everett's class. Yeah. Chris Stefanik was, I think, a year or two ahead of us, but was there at the same time. Yeah. Mm. Great people there at that time.
Matthew Kelly, right?
Matthew Kelly. I was in Austria with him. He was only there for a few semesters, but yeah, there were a lot of great people. And it was an inspiring time to, kind of be doing ministry.
And you studied under Barbara Jordan Morgan?
Barbara Morgan, yeah. who founded the catechetics program there. And she was kind of a giant as far as wanting catechetics to be taught and done well. She was great. But she also, I definitely loved theology, but I wouldn't say I'm the most academically oriented person. I remember, towards my end of my time there, she decided to start this it's like a feared test now that still happens, but it's called the catechism test. And you have to...
You have nightmares about it?
So. Yeah, I mean, I through the grace of God, I passed the thing. But it's basically, I don't know, say it's 70 questions or something, but it's to, the whole thing is set up to prove that you read the catechism, because they want you to read it cover to cover. And so they have all these questions that, you know, multiple choice, it could be 3 out of the 6 are right, you know, or 2 or none, or and you're having, you know, it's just really a difficult test. And if you didn't pass it, you couldn't get that. You can graduate with a theology degree, but you couldn't graduate with a catechetics degree. And so, you know, she really made sure that you knew the faith, but also you knew the language of the church and stuff like that. So she was a great teacher. It was definitely a neat time to be within that program as they were developing.
And so growing up, you were in church on Sunday and CCD.
I have lots of tattoos, which I can't see over the audio waves. But that is a common misperception, is that, you know, I think people think, yeah, I must have had the craziest past in the world, you know. But the reality is, yeah, I was kind of a relatively normal upbringing. You know, I had some, you know, things that, like everyone else, some rough times, but nothing where I was, you know, robbing stores or something. I just got tattoos and they stay forever.
And what part of Philadelphia did you?
So north of the city, like Montgomery County, Montgomeryville, Bucks County, that area.
Okay. And you mentioned you spent some time at St. Charles. Y'all would visit it?
Yeah, so I remember we a couple of priests that were at our parish that, you know, would like to take people down. And I would go down sometimes with one of those priests for, you know, we would have dinner, and then we would hear the guys do, I guess it would be Vespers. I'm trying to think what it would have been. But, you know, they would sing night prayer in the chapel. And I thought that was so cool. And there was, I have a lot of memories of it being, you know, snowy. So it must have been something that they did in the winter. But I remember seeing a seminarian on a skateboard in that tunnel that's connecting those buildings and thinking, you know, wow, this is so cool. Like maybe I could be a priest. It actually made me think, like, oh, all right, these guys are normal guys. You know, like I it was a really like kind of formative memory, you know, going to St. Charles, because I thought like it was mysterious enough to like pique my interest, but it also seemed like normal guys. It was my first experience, you know, with seminarians. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah. And then you originally wanted to study theater. Did you do that in high school?
So I was very involved in high school in theater. You know, some of my close friends ended up going on and doing stuff in Broadway. So that was kind of my goal at the time. I was like, I would love to just do stage.
They made it on Broadway.
Yeah.
You got to be really good, don't you?
Yeah. There's some musical theaters like AMDA and stuff like that that some of them went to. And I went to the biggest public high school in Pennsylvania. So it's called North Penn. And the theater program was, you know, it was a big deal. You know, they had just gigantic budgets and lots of directors, stuff like that. You know, so it was something that it was pretty big. I was never great at sports. And it was also like when you go to a school that big, even if you were okay, you're never going to get the play. Right, it was just way too many. It had 1,000 people in my grade, you know, so it was kind of a difficult thing, and theater ended up really being something that I felt kind of drawn to. It was kind of cool, but
It must have been hard to make the theater cut. You
know, I guess that's true. I never really thought of it that way. Yeah. In my mind, it was just I'm so bad at sports. Like, I guess I could do theater. But you're right. There were a lot of people involved in theater as well. It just wasn't as intimidating to me, and it was something I really realized. You know, I love, you know, is, yeah, performing arts, music, that kind of thing.
So you're something of a singer?
So I used to, for a long time, we didn't talk about it on the show today, but I used to travel and do hip-hop, rap, you know, so, and that was one of the things that I, you know, kind of gleaned from my time in the inner city stuff. So it was Catholic stuff, but I would use it as, you know, kind of a fun tool with the inner city kids. Obviously that's kind of a big thing to them. And but it was also it's very lighthearted, you know, improvisational. And, you know, so with that, I ended up, you know, getting booked at other parishes and dioceses. We'd have me do things. And then I was like, oh, maybe I should do this for a little bit. And so there were a period of years that's all I did. Actually, I stepped away, from the parish and just traveled, did music for a few years. And it was good, but then it was just a little too much travel for me.
Were you married then?
Or? I was, yeah. We were, this is probably five years into our marriage. Okay. And it was, it was something we felt like mm-hmm. God was kind of moving. And it was cool because I would still involve the inner city mm-hmm. kids, you know, bring them with me or mm-hmm. have them perform, or, you know, some of them were amazingly talented kids. But I would use the hip hop, you know, to kind of share the gospel.
Yeah. And like acting itself, what drew you to that, to be on stage? And to me, it seems terrifying to have to cry on stage or something.
Yeah, you know, it just seems. I think I just, it probably was that kind of thing. I remember seeing some actors that I was like, man, it's so cool that they're able to be so raw and, you know, kind of elicit a response or an emotion, or, you know, we've all experienced that if we see a play, Les Mis or something like that, and you're so moved, you know, it's a fake story, but mm-hmm. it's still, you know, obviously communicating some universal truths. And I that was really moving to me. I remember seeing the first show I ever saw on Broadway was The Who's Tommy. Which, you know, it's pretty abstract, but it was pretty moving to me, you know, mm. just to, you know, to experience something like that through, you know, music and script and acting. And I think I like being a part of, I guess in a way there's some, now that I'm saying it out loud, there's some crossovers probably with, you know, what I like about ministry, to be able to kind of help elicit a response out of people, you know, now to God, but as opposed to just for the sake of emotion's sake.
Yeah. And so in all of this, you went to Denver, right? World Youth Day.
Yeah. So Jim Beckman, whose name we mentioned right before this, he was at Steubenville, and he had mentioned to me, I had met him at a conference when I was a little younger, and he called me, you know, on the phone and said, oh, you know, the university is going to take, I don't know, 10 buses or 17 buses. So it was a, you know, a big thing out to this World Youth Day. I didn't know what it was.
So you were...
I would have been in high school.
High school.
You know,
okay.
So yeah. I was finishing high school. Mm. And I don't think anyone really knew what it was, you know, at least my age. You know, never. Now we're kind of, you know, familiar with it. But it just... sounded like a cool trip and sounded mm-hmm. fun. I like Jim, you know, I got a couple of my friends go with me, and you know, you always think of retreats and stuff like that, you're like, well, we'll meet some girls and it'll be fun, you know. And it just ended up being one of those scarring, you know, moments in your life that you know, you look back to a lot of times today at Mass, just thinking about some of my memories from there. But it was, you know, a first powerful encounter that I had, like, you know, connecting myself to, you know, St. John Paul II, but also just, I think, as a young people to see, wow, like I you know, just I had never seen the church like that, especially in America,
you right. know?
And it gave me so much hope, so much excitement that I wanted to be a part of. Yeah, I didn't know exactly what it was, but I, you know, I wanted to be a part of it, and mm-hmm. it was really cool. You know, so we just took buses. We slept. I remember we would stop and just sleep on floors at like schools and stuff. It was like, you know, a pilgrimage and in every sense. And so it was pretty neat. You know, like as a high school kid, I felt like to experience it.
Yeah, and the Donna singing, "We Are One Body," and that was like an iconic moment.
I mean, that song is overplayed as it got, and by the end, you know, not at that moment, but, you know, 10 years, 20 years later, you're still like, oh, stop singing that song, you know. But for so long, you know, every time I would hear that song, it really kind of brings you back to, you know, that feeling of being there, and, you know, the church kind of rallying around, you know, that song was really really beautiful.
Are you describing it as scarring, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think scarring in a good way. I know that I guess in an odd choice of words, but something where it's like, man, there was a, you know, kind of changes you.
Yeah,
you know, like not easily forgotten. You know, I guess there would have been a more apt way to put it, but yeah, really left an imprint, you know, on my life.
Yeah. And we had today is the feast day of St. John Paul II. I preached at the noon mass, and I mentioned in there about at Cherry Creek State Park, him going up those steps. Do you remember that? Were you there?
Yeah.
See it? I don't know if you could see it even where you're at or.
Yeah, I do remember that. It was really wild just because it was so big. I mean, I just had no idea the church was even that big, but it was, it just felt, everything about it felt epic.
You know?
And to him coming in to the helicopter, like the helicopter couldn't land. I mean, I'm sure you've heard those stories, you know, like I was in that stadium that, you know, the day before, and it was just so, so loud. And I didn't even understand what, like World Youth Day, I thought it was a one day thing. And then, you know, it was like a couple days in a row. It just, everything about it was like mysterious and weird and wonderful. But yeah, I didn't know, didn't get to see it from, I guess, like a bird's eye view, like you were describing it.
Yeah.
But you knew in the moment that it was like something was big was happening.
Yeah.
You know, this was like a big deal. You know, it kind of felt like you showed up at Woodstock or something. You're like, wow, this is going to be...
That's what they call it, Catholic Woodstock.
Yeah, it really it feels like that. You know, people are smelly. There's not enough porta pots. In that sense, too, it's like, man, it's a wild experience. But it was pretty formative.
Yeah, we had a guy in the community for a while that he went, and he wound up getting this terrible sunburn and blisters on his. He had to be taken off in an ambulance. So he had this bad experience.
But yeah, there were a lot. I remember at that closing mass, that, you know, it was so hot, and there kept being people that would get, you know, taken out on a gurney because they were passing out from the sun. The sun was a big deal. And then I remember we ended up having to hike that last day, like almost 10 miles to get out to, you know, everything was just so crowded in the streets. No one would, they're like, you're going to have to hike back to your buses. And it just, in my mind, it took 10 hours. I'm sure it didn't, but it was so long.
And you're carrying gear.
Yeah, you're carrying your gear and, you know.
You don't have nice backpacks or anything, right? You just got something to slip.
Exactly. I think you know, the longer you're going, people are just leaving that stuff. There's just stuff everywhere. It was really like, it kind of devolved quickly into just a mess. But as a, you know, high school kid, you can handle it. You know, you can
put up
with a little mess. Now it's like I went to a few, you know, like as an adult, and I'm like, man, I cannot sleep out in this field again. Like, this is just, I know it, you know, it's beautiful and it's a great time of grace, but it's like, there's only so many times you could sleep in a field, with a million other people before.
Yeah, it's
too much.
I was in Lisbon this last one, and one of the brothers sent me a clip, or it's just a YouTube of his closing homily at Denver. And, you know, I watched the whole thing and I was kind of amazed, you know, because he studied theater, right? He was an actor and everything. And I felt like he was so casual. He's like holding the text in his hand, and sometimes he might pause and repeat something. But it wasn't like this huge theatrics at all. You know, you got the feeling he's just delivering the homily, just kind of talking. And, you know, I thought, and he would say, people would ask him, how do you connect all these young people? What's drawing these young? And he said, it's the Holy Spirit, you know, is working. And he draws them because, I mean, definitely he could, you could see clips of him giving dramatic homilies and stuff, but I was kind of surprised how subdued it was.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, and but it, I don't know. It kind of, you know, I guess it just really struck me as this isn't some show.
Yeah, right.
You know, he came out and threw some red meat to the people,
something
to really feed the people.
Right,
you know?
Right. And I remember feeling like that. You know, like, man, would not be waiting with bated breath, you know, normally at my Sunday homily, you know, but they, I remember us all being, you know, around like a radio because they were translating it and stuff like that. But I do think, yeah, obviously the Holy Spirit is at work and there's something powerful happening like in that moment. I remember one of the other ones I went to was in Toronto. And that was, man, I was actually with Father Dave Bavanka at that one who you're talking about earlier. But I remember it started raining and we just were trying to, there was probably 10 of us under this little tarp and it was in the mud and all this kind of stuff. But he had, Pope John Paul II had, that's when he had said that, you know, you're not the sum of your weaknesses and failures. And I remember at that moment writing it, you know, on like in the cover of my Bible, like, oh my gosh, what, you know, that really cut me to the core. What a great, great message. But, you know, like to be in real time in some of those moments was pretty neat.
Yeah. I was at that one too with a group. I was like a handful of one of the chaperones that were there. And yeah, we were out there and I remember him saying, it's like to the Saturday evening vigil. He goes, "Now don't go home." He'd say, and I remember I just felt this surge. Yeah, we're with you.
Right. It really is a wild thing.
Yeah.
And he was such a. I was thinking about this during Mass day. Like he was such a grandfatherly, you know, figure. Mm. I feel like to in my life, you know, I just it was like the Pope that I knew, you know, my whole life basically, and. I just remember just that same kind of, you know, love that you would have for your grandfather. Like it was kind of an intimate, even though like, you know, I never touched the man before, and, you know, never sat down and had a conversation with him, but there was a, like kind of this intimacy that was really, that you could tell everyone is experiencing that
like
in his pastoral words and in even just the tone of his voice and just, you're right, the Holy Spirit, you know, doing something.
Yeah, and I felt, he was like, as George Weigel titled his book, you know, Witness to Hope, he was such a sign of hope because he just seemed like, you know, he just had this holiness, this solidity about him that, and I just marvel at how you could have a pontificate without any, I mean, there was some controversies, but nothing, you know, serious. I mean, people make whatever about the CC thing. I don't know what happened, but he defended a CC, you know, in the book, you know, I think in Jeevish's books, they talk about it. But so, I mean, to have that length of pontificate, I mean, you had the church scandals, but
sure.
You know, he wasn't in charge of all that.
But even that, you know, I'm sure you've thought about this before, but I had someone pointed out, you know, like when he was, that you know, that one year where he was just apologizing, you know, for, and that was pre, you know, I feel like that just this repentance, you know, you know, kind of was a precursor to all that, which I think, man, how appropriate now in retrospect that, because I remember some people being annoyed that there was just such a heavy focus on repentance.
And, I think that was like leading up to the Jubilee year.
Right. And then, you know, it wasn't long after that, but you're like, wow, you know, that was the right way for us to, you know, for him to lead, you know, was with repentance, not knowing now what, you know, we're going into.
Right. And two, I like the way he ended, you know, he had those two great, I don't know what they're encyclicals, but on the Eucharist and on Our Lady of the Rosary, you know, people pointed out, it's like the image of the Don Bosco dream of the church, the embattled church passing through between the Eucharist and Our Lady on the pillars. And then Jason Everett points out, you know, in St. Peter's, he's buried between that. They have the Adoration Chapel in St. Peter's, his tomb, and you have the Pietà, you know, on the other side. So he's like, he's there. But I mean, that document on the Eucharist is just, to me, it's like a catechetical masterpiece. Yeah, I mean, it's just packed with so much stuff. And of course, well, whenever he talks about Our Lady, my one quote I mentioned, like this catechesis on Our Lady, I forgot, in the 90s, it's just masterful, you know, and it has like the right amount of kind of boldness about, you know, her co-redemptrix, her suffering with, you know, but she doesn't cross any lines or go too far. And it, and it's just so powerful. And but yeah, the way he could write about these things in such a clear and solid way and just cover the bases, you know, it's just like he says it and he's always just careful to avoid the extremes.
Sure.
And he anticipates them and stuff. And it's just such a solid teacher and careful thinker.
Yeah, we're so blessed to be alive during that time. You know, what a great time.
And I've heard these stories on more than one occasion. Like, I know a priest that he visited. He was in a receiving line after Mass. And it was, I think it was one of the CFRs, I think, and they were just starting their community. And the priest was fearful of the rocks, you know, the raft might break up on the rocks, so to speak. And and John Paul said, you know, something like, don't be afraid, you know, gave him a rosary or something. And he walked off, but he turned around, came back and said, don't be afraid, you know. And now that I'm thinking too, it might have been that there was a guy up in the priest. I think another story like that was, the priest who ran the retreat house of the Archdiocese of New York. He told that kind of story. But anyway, and that he would say, Weigel's book, I mean, I read that, and that was, Weigel just packs so much theology and history. I mean, that book is so anointed. And, by subsequent books, right, Weigel's written, it just seemed like John Paul really loved the book. I feel like it really got his approval. And so to me, it was just a great presentation of him. And one line in there, he talked about that he described himself as a man of great trust. And he said he learned it at Yasnogora, Czestochowa. And he said, when all hope seems lost, we see in Mary's fiat to trust, even when all hope seems lost, And I thought, that is it. I don't, the simple handmaid of the Lord in this hillbilly, outskirts town of Nazareth, 50 families.
Yeah, right.
The whole incarnation depends on her. And she just says yes. And it takes her to the cross, sees her son crucified, Wow. It's like, what is more devastation than that? So we say yes with Mary, she strengthens us. And I've just experienced that so many times, and it's like, he just, to me, just pulled back the veil on all that. But
he was a gift, for sure.
So, and again, in your story, like, you get married, how'd you meet your wife? You were at the catechetical program, you said?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So my wife is funny because so she was a year ahead of me. We were in Austria studying because the Franciscan University has not just the campus in Steubenville, but they have this campus in Gaming, Austria, which is a Carthusian monastery. And at the time, it maybe just been going on for a couple of years, and so the program was relatively small. You're over there with maybe 100. Maybe less at the time, students. And so I didn't really know her until we went there. And back in the States, I knew that she was in this household, in the household systems at Franciscan, like small faith communities. And she had started one for women that were discerning being a nun. Mm-hmm. And so, she was pretty on that track. And
is that the Bride of Christ?
It's called Spouse of the Spirit. Mary, Spouse of the Spirit. Okay. Yeah. So close. Yeah. Still spouse, but wrong person in the Trinity. When we were over there, it was funny because at that time I was thinking that, maybe I was going to be a priest. It was just something I was at least discerning. I always tell, young people now, look, you've got to at least just spend a little bit of time thinking about it. You know what I mean? Or you're, a pansy, because, like this is something that should be a part of everyone's, life discernment. It's like, is God calling me to this? And that was that time for me. And, but I remember saying to Kate one time, and she always teases me about this now, but I was like, well, you know, maybe we could like join the same order. It'd be so fun, you know? And she's like, it just sounded weird. Yeah. She said like, you know, like we could both be CFRs or something. Cause she had gone and visited the CFRs and was pretty sure she was going to join. But cause she's like, because then I realized I like you, you know? And, you know, so we start dating. Well, not before I was talking to my spiritual director, who was a Dominican, Father Giles. And
Giles Dimmick,
yeah, you know him,
yeah.
Okay, yeah, great man. Yeah. And he would always he was a great person for me because he was able to kind of you know, he can handle my weirdness, but he wasn't afraid to sometimes like tell me to, you know, get in line. And I remember, you know, just one time I was we were having spiritual direction. It was kind of back in the choir room, and I said, I'm not sure what to do. You know, I'm discerning. But I really think I like Kate, you know, mm-hmm. and I just am feeling so guilty. I don't know what, you know, I don't know what to do. And then he said, you know, I don't normally tell people this, but I don't think you're going to be a priest, Bob. You know, like, it was like funny because I was like, oh, you know, and it wasn't like he was saying, you know, that was like the defendee, but he was like, I think you should just invest in this friendship. And, you know, if it turns into something more than that, then that's great. And that's what happened. We, you know, we started dating and we got married. Like I said, I had a class with a final with Alan Schreck the night before I got married. And then I got married in our campus on at Steubenville. I slept in the dorm the night before I finished, you know. And,
oh, at Christ the King.
At Christ the King, yeah.
That must have been scary. Did you have a job lined up or anything?
So the kind of, like I was mentioning that origin story with Vagabond, we were going to New York, but I didn't really know what we were getting into. Yeah. I just, you know, took this job at a parish there. So yeah, we had that in line, but you know, when you're young and dumb, you know, you're just like, oh, whatever. I say I'm probably a pretty spontaneous, you know, like odd person. And so all that stuff seemed fun to me. But at the time too, it was like, you know, I don't know, getting married seemed like a lot of fun. And
the tattoos didn't scare
her. Yeah, it didn't scare her off. Yeah, so, yeah. So yeah, so we met there. Again, both thought we were going to enter a different vocation, and you know, turned out we. Yeah. Man, my friend always teased me. Like, one of my guys in my grooms, one of my groomsmen, was like, you know, I think you guys are going to have a great life, but I think you're going to go to hell for stealing cake from being a nun. You know, because everyone thought, man, for sure she was going to be a nun, but I guess God had other plans because now we got a million kids.
Yeah. And to me, part of your story, what sounds tough to me is like, you know, building an organization from scratch, dealing with all the relationships, building the structures, having to work with young people, missionaries, you have to mentor them, guide them, you know, maybe correct them. That seems, were you prepared for all that?
No. And you know, I really, you know, credit a lot of the people that have been at the helm since I left, because I feel like, you know, to a certain extent, I feel like we ran on pure, you know, emotion for as long as we could, you know, or just, you know, just because like, I, you know, I'm not business minded, you know, or, you know, not, you know, great at looking at, you know, the structure of a nonprofit and how this thing, you know, it was just like, God just kind of blessed it. And, you know, I remember our first, you know, year we were trying to raise $6,000, and that was the goal. You know, I was still like kind of working at a parish. I was like, well, if we can raise $6,000 here, we could buy a van. You know, it was an old, you know, junky van, obviously. But like, I think in the beginning, I don't think there really was a whole lot of thought of self-preservation. You know, I didn't think, well, in 10 years, you know, or in 20 years, and now, you know, like that, this thing is going to be around. So I want to lay the foundation. You know, it was just like, I just wanted to get some people around us that were willing to kind of take a risk and live a completely missionary life. In fact, when we first started, I wasn't even going to have money a part of it. I was like, well, we don't need to pay people. You know, people could just, you know, like thinking about the lives of the saints or whatever, and you think like, you know, we'll just have people that want to see this kind of impact of the gospel in these marginalized areas, and we'll live together, and we'll change a city, you know? And so it was funny, you know, the way that I think in the beginning that I didn't have any of those things you mentioned about, you know, mm-hmm. the ability, I think, to structure that. It was just kind of a you know, a God moment, I guess, that God blessed some of that, and we had the right people and that kind of thing. But I don't think at the time it stressed me out, because I just never thought this is going to be something to be around for a while. I just thought, yeah, this is something we're going to do right now. We'll see what happens. I actually, the first time when we were first starting, I called like 6 or 7 of the teens that were part of that initial like inner city youth group that, you know, because when we were starting that right out of college, and to this day, I don't know that we've ever had a more anointed time. You know, like I remember, you know, there was, one year there's over 20 kids in RCIA, you know. At that time, we used to call it catacombs. You know, they would come and we would just go over the faith and stuff. But there was so much happening there that I you know, gathered a group of these guys together in a diner, and I gave them the pitch for Vagabond Missions, which at the time I called Dirty Vagabond Ministries, because again, there wasn't a whole lot of thought of like, well, you know, they take this the wrong, you know. But I was just like, man, I love the idea that it was actually Pope John Paul II called Christ the Divine Wayfarer. And I love that idea, you know, it's a synonym to vagabond in some ways, you know, just that idea that Christ didn't have a home or necessarily a good reputation, mm-hmm. you know, but it was like, this is who we want to model, you know, like we talked about earlier with incarnation. And so I threw it out to these guys, this is what I'm going to start. And I'm just looking for some people that want to kind of throw their lives away and do this. You know, I don't really have the plan, but if anyone wants to do it, I just thought, you know, you can move in and we can get this thing started. And like one by one, they're like, I don't think it's for me, it's not for me. And then there was one of those guys who was like, I'll do it. You know, and he was our first missionary.
So he was actually living with you guys?
Yeah. And in fact, going back to that moment now, so now, there are 4 of the guys from that initial thing. Some of them later in their life, you know, after they're married and stuff, mm-hmm. came back and now work for Vagabond, which is, you know, kind of weird and ironic. But yeah, that one guy and that ultimately a couple of them ended up living with us. But that was in the beginning. Kind of our model was like, well, we could kind of live in community. And the missionaries still do live in community. But in the beginning, it was very unformed and very just, you know, radical, I guess. So
But yeah, it just sounded like it just took 100% from you, doesn't it, to keep that thing?
Yeah, it definitely did. And it also definitely, you know, I feel like there was a sense that it was very draining for a young person, you know, to kind of face some of these realities that you see in the poor, just, you know, some of the plight, some of the wounds, the abuse, all that kind of stuff. And I remember thinking that I don't know that this could be something that we do long term because it was so heavy. But it was like God would keep putting other good people there in place to kind of shoulder that burden. And that's really what kept it going. It certainly wasn't me. So there's God had always kind of put some special people there, I think, to do the work alongside him.
Like lay people, maybe sometimes bring in their specialty, if maybe a psychologist, counselor, or just even some experience in business to maybe help.
Right. And that was it. Like as we started forming the board of directors, you know, you pull people in who are good in these things. And I mean, it's one of the, I feel like the greatest things I ever did is just realize, oh, we need to get some people that are different than us and gifted in other areas and know how to
bring the nerds in.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. No, just different type of nerds, definitely.
But what about, I mean, to me, it just seemed like it'd be so hard just to deal with the personalities of, I remember one time, they still, I think, do have an after school care at one of the, it's basically in a government housing project. And I guess it was during the school year because it was after school, but I remember going out there with the guy that was organizing it, and there was just so much rage in the kids. Yeah. I was like shocked the way they would scream at each other and stuff.
Yeah.
And like dealing with that, or even just dealing with the problems with the missionaries, you know, that would come up, that just seemed like such a challenge, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, you're right. It's a both and, and it is shocking. It's a shocking thing to see that, you know, the fact that you have that memory is obviously proof of that, you know, that to see so much hurt and, you know, the reality is, I think, we probably all have, you know, like different things inside of us that are broken and ugly and hurting like that, you know, but I notice with the inner city kids, it's like they have a lot less coping mechanisms. They have a lot less things to hide behind, you know, like it's like when there's ugliness in their life, it's just, it's right there and it's in your face and it's really ugly. And to a certain degree, like there's something that's, I think honest and even good about that, you know, that you see sometimes like in those moments that sin, or not that all of the, that angst or angers from sin, but you do see, you know, kind of the ugliness of sin a little bit more when it's not sugarcoated or we're not able to, you know, hide behind maybe stuff, you know, or talents or whatever. That some of that ugliness of the inner city was honestly freeing, you know, like just because there was a sense of watching the way that they came to Christ and how just like, you know, like it draws up some wounds. It also, the good thing that it draws up is like this acceptance of yourself that, you know, you could see, you know, how they allow Jesus to, you know, to be their savior and to be their perfect, you know, for God to be their perfect father, you know, and these things, you know, like I feel like some of those things really helped me in my spiritual walk, you know, just to internalize some of that and to realize that, you know, I'm loved by God, you know, in that same way.
Yeah. And so like working at Steubenville as the director of student evangelization, and you see kids come out of a modern secular culture and with all the masking that can happen.
Yeah, right.
What are some of the big challenges there that you feel like, maybe let's talk about the negative, like stuff that maybe really damages them, or is it, you know, is it the all the screen time? Is it the divorced family? Mm. Is it, you know?
Yeah, I think it's funny because I was talking to my father-in-law about this, who could tend to be more negative when you look at, you know, all the problems facing the modern world, modern church, you know, just modern young people. Yeah. And I think it's almost like a hopeless thing for him to see, you know, like the look at all how much pornography is there. Look at these kids, like the screen time, all this part of culture is very broken. But the one thing I was telling him, there's no sugarcoating that, you know, those things are evils that are running rampant and in a lot of ways, I think, a really poor part of the culture. But the one thing that I, on a hopeful, not to turn to turn the conversation, but that I see with the students is where, you know, I know, like for me, for instance, you know, I got my first cell phone, you know, as an adult, you know, and I wasn't used to, I didn't grow up with the internet, you know what I mean? And so you start to, I don't know exactly, as we started having kids, I'm like, I don't know exactly how to parent a kid through this because like, I didn't go through this. Yeah. You know, you could think of, you know, how to walk a kid through if he's getting bullied at school. Yeah, I could remember that, or I, you know, maybe, you know, different things like kind of on a natural level, but I never had a cell phone. I never had internet access. I never had, you know, and obviously there's things that you could do, I think, to parent your kid well, but I think they're going to do a much better job of parenting their kids, you know, through it because they've faced how hard these challenges are. Like I think of my, I just had two kids get married, and I think Yeah, I'm really proud. And I see this at Steubenville too. You know, it's just a lot of the amount that of times that I'm with a student and they have their phone out is it's rare. You know, I would say they're just because they're starting to learn, you know, like you just leave it put away, or, you know, try and, you know, what tools, what bumpers can I put on to avoid, you know, pornography, different things like that. And I think they'll actually do much better. I mean, at least that's my hope, is that there'll be some self-correction within the culture there.
Yeah.
But those things, those are the evils for sure. Yeah. You know, is that these students are coming to Franciscan or any college, you know, and they have grown up with this unbridled access to the bad things on the internet. Yeah. And I don't think any of us realize how bad it was, you know, until, you know, recently, at Steubenville, but any of us as adults, that, you know, man, there's a lot of young people that have been looking at pornography every day since like middle school, right, you know? Right. And I relate it to if you were to eat, you know, for 10 or, you know, whatever, 15 years or 20 years, whatever, eat a radioactive breakfast, you know, and eventually something
sugar
weird is
pops.
Gonna happen. Yeah, right. not too far from radioactivity. But, you know, eventually something really bad is gonna happen.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, you're gonna grow a third eye or, you know, like lose your feet or something. You know, and in the same way, I think that's one of the things we see now too, is, you know, some these heinous things that, you know, crimes, different things like that. I think some of that is all just, it's fruit of life, you know, addicted to, you know, pornography and stuff like that. So that's a very, very difficult thing to face.
Yeah, it seems like they have a fraternist group in town that's big. It was the biggest, I don't know if it still is, but it was like the biggest chapter in the country. And I remember they, you know, they initially talked about it as like helping teenage boys, right? But then there was this discussion about, it was like just as much for the parent, the fathers that would come to the meetings, that, you know, fathers are encouraged to be there, and it's almost like just to help connect fathers to their kids, you know? And it just seems like, you know, the things that separate that linkage, I mean, I even think of, this is my kind of theory, but I, like World War II, you had the returning vets and ton of PTSD, maybe a lot of drinking, maybe a lot of isolation from their children, you know, that had a huge damage, right?
Yeah,
culture. And so this is another struggle, you know, we have now, you know, maybe the alienation, isolation of the screen time and separation and lack of just talking or communicating, you know, at the dinner table every night. And I say too, it's like, you know, I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, we're basically kind of watching the same thing on television, right? And you could talk about that.
Yeah, right.
You know, when Fonzie jumped the shark, you know, whatever it was, we're all in the family. And now everybody can get in their own little entertainment ghetto.
Yeah.
You know, and I've talked
to interesting.
Yeah. It's like, it's kind of further separates us, right? And I could find my niche stuff, whatever. But then too, the scary thing too, is I've talked to more than one set of parents that like their kids got into these internet ghettos, like maybe promoting transgender stuff, you know, and sexual identity questions. And because they found some kind of community there. Mm-hmm. They were isolated. They found it there. They get radicalized and maybe led into these behaviors and things. And it's like, whoa. I mean, like you said, you can just find everything out there now.
Yeah. And that's, I think, what's the most scary is, especially as a teenager, you know, you have so many questions and so many thoughts and hormones and, you know, and so all of a sudden now you have like access to, to just everything, not just pornography, but you're right. Like these just different groups and people saying stuff and, you know, you could find someone who will agree with any theory you have about anything. And, and then the algorithms continue to, you know, press into that. And so it's what a dangerous time that, you know, the first feeling or thought or whatever you have, that's just, it's applauded. And I think it's a really scary time, you know, you know, for teenagers, you know, with that access, and as parents, obviously have to do our best to hold that back. But it's a lot of times I feel like it's a tidal wave, you know, culture, and it's hard to hold it back.
And yeah, the flip side, and I joined the community here at UBTN in 94. And so we've always had people coming through the network that had ministry and stuff. But I just feel like it's just been an explosion of like the role of the laity. Mm-hmm. And there's so much good stuff out there. There's so many good websites. There's so many good YouTube channels. There's so many good podcasts. There's books, you know. I mean, there's so much great material. I went to Colorado School of Mines, you know, graduated early 90s outside of Denver. And there was like a little Newman House that we would have mass. I forgot how often it was. I don't think it was every Sunday, but there was so little there present. I mean, now they have focused missionaries. Mm-hmm. They have an adoration chapel on campus. And I remember like my jaw just dropped open. I said, wow, you know, if that would have been here when I was here, you know, that might have really impacted me. And so, yeah, I think focus, you know, just alone is such a great source of hope. You know, it's just present on so many campuses. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You have something to plug in. So there's a lot of great stuff, but it seems like it's just a big catch up, you know, and then to the struggles of the family, you know, it just seems like it always comes back to that.
But, yeah, you're right. That is a real positive thing to think of, you know, like how much access to good things is available now too. You're right. That's a really positive thing.
Yeah. And some signs of hope that you see that encourage you, that maybe in the morning you spring out of bed and click your heels. I mean, is there something that?
I love working at Steubenville at Franciscan. It's just talk about a lot of hope. You know, it's just if you like young people, I feel like, you know, if you don't like young people, you probably wouldn't like working with them, whether they were, you know, Catholic or not, because they're still, you know, they still can make mistakes and they're silly and they're, you know, whatever. But I get so much hope there, just seeing how many people still desire for holiness, you know, above other things, and that, you know, in a world that, you know, is always, even now, you know, where I think, you know, maybe the thing was before, you know, get rich, you know, now I feel like the biggest rich is, you know, get famous, you know, that's kind of the, you know, I would say like the modern day obsession, is fame. And 'cause the access to it, right. With YouTube and all these things. But I think something very helpful for me is that, there are a lot of young people, that are in love with Christ and the church. And instead of, you know, heading towards what is the way they could be noticed most, or, you know, most famous, or, you know, have the most power, that they're willing, kind of like that rich young man, to leave all that stuff aside, and follow the Lord, and to see now some of the ways that in return God has really blessed, you know, who they are and what they're doing, you know, just people that are holy, you know, holy businessmen, holy nurses, you know, obviously there's vocations and stuff like that. But for me to see, you know, someone who at the peak of when you're obsessing about what am I going to do in my life? How am I going to make money? How am I going to, you know, do something important and something that counts? You know, one of the things that I think post-millennials don't get enough credit for is, and this is just on a secular level too, you know, that they put their money where their mouth is, you know, I read that the amount of service and the amount of money that they donate, you know, like it's exponentially higher than, you know, when I was their age, or, you know, our parents were their age. So there's something there that I feel like God is really working within the natural state of what is happening with them as a generation. I feel like if God and the Spirit is able to move within that, you know, it just, it kind of multiplies, yeah, you know, what's already happening. Their desire to make their lives count, their desire for justice, their desire for these things, you know, it's a really exciting thing, I think, to be a part of. Yeah.
I've heard that in secular. I have a doctor friend works with interns and stuff, and he sees a greater generosity in the younger generation.
I read that like several years ago, just because there's so much negative from millennials that and whatever they're calling the generation now. And I feel like sometimes we don't realize, but there are some good things too, you know, like there's good things within each generation. And some of those things I feel like are, you know, springboards that, you know, definitely God can use to do bigger things.
Yeah. I think Mother Teresa said it, that is that with every newborn, you know, it's a sign, every infant, that it's a sign that God hasn't given up on the world. You know, he keeps sending life. And you see that in young people with their openness, their generosity. You know, I always say too, like, it's like they don't have anything, right? So they're not held back. You know, they haven't built an empire, you know, whatever. So they have this freedom to give themselves to something and be behind causes and, you know, jump on board with things and just a witness to the joy of the gospel, you know, that they get excited by it and excited about the message and things. And that's a great sign of hope. And maybe just in your work with young people on campus there, you know, you're trained catechist. What's some of the big themes that you find yourself teaching a lot on or that resonates with young people?
I think that something that I get asked a lot, and it's become a real passion of mine is trying to teach prayer more, you know, just because I think there is sometimes an assumption, at least on our campus, I think sometimes is, you know, people are having these conversion or ongoing conversion, and sometimes, you know, there's more of a focus on, like turn away from sin or, you know, do these things and start to walk with Christ. But there's not always a lot of explicit teaching on, okay, so when I sit down tomorrow morning to pray, like, what actually should I do? You know, I know I'm talking to God, but like, walk me through that, you know? Yeah. And obviously we see that with the disciples asking the Lord to teach them to pray. But it's something that I've tried to do, you know, so every now, the last several years, every Lent, we do something called the School of Prayer, where every Monday night we have a different speaker, and it's sometimes a friar, sometimes a professor, sometimes, you know, a staff member, whatever. But teaching a very practical method of prayer, like in the sense that I always say, like one of my favorite questions to ask now of my friends or people getting to know is, how do you pray? Like when you pray, what do you do? You know, how do you start? What things do you do? You know, and it's really interesting to just, I think sometimes, because it's almost embarrassing to ask, you know, because you don't want someone to think like, oh, like you don't even know how to pray. No, I pray, you know, but like it's nice to always learn, you know, in the same sense that if you were really into lifting weights, you know, it's good to find out like, what do you do for your shoulders? You know, what do you do to isolate that muscle and grow in that way? I think it's been really transformative experience for the students, because I think it's going back to the basics of, you know, prayer is such a fundamental thing for us that it's really been neat to see, you know, how hungry they are and how much they desire. And so when we do these nights, like the whole goal is that, you know, they'll have something that tomorrow morning or that night when they go to bed that they can do for prayer, you know. And I find that amidst all the complex cultural, you know, things that these students are going through, that tends to be one that really rises to the top, you know. It's this idea of, how do I communicate with this God that we hear about so much and I know loves me, and but, you know, how do I do that in an intimate way? What does that look like? That, to me, as a catechist, that's a really fun thing to walk with a student in.
And that must have been a challenge in your life with 7 kids, the ministry, to find that time for prayer.
Yeah, my wife, you know, it's obviously, it's nice probably how you have a community. You know, it's definitely nice to have someone help with balance, because I tend to, like I said before, just be kind of radical, or, you know, I'd always, like, you know, during Lent, I'd always want to do something crazy. I'd sleep in the alley or something, you know. My wife, you're not doing that, you know. But so for me, I always get up really early in the morning, and I pray, you know, before they get up, an hour before they get up. So if they get up at 6:30, I was trying to get up at 5:30. Yeah. And there's been times, like, you know, where my wife has had to tell me, like, all right, you know, like, we've been up all night with these babies. Yeah. Like, you do not need to get up right now and pray. Like, we need to, you know, kind of help each other here, because our prayer right now is not going to look the same as it did when we were in college and had that time. Or it's not going to look the same as... Yeah. You know, this monk that you like to read about has, you know, and so, yeah, it's a, definitely a challenge, but I feel like it's such a fun thing to go through, to learn, you know, within your state and how do you pray honestly? Because an honest prayer at, you know, when you have, you know, multiple screaming babies, you know, is going to look different than an honest prayer when you have more time and availability and access to Christ.
Right. Well, Bob, thank you so much for coming to the network, doing the show and the podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for all you guys do here. It's awesome.